key is to trust that the right card will appear when you need it most. Is this your card?
That's my signature. That's amazing.
Oh, man. You're free to go, buddy. You're too good. Magic is the best. I live alone and have nothing. And no one.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul. That's Simon Cornell. Back.
That's accurate.
Back from the land of traveling.
Again.
Right up top, before I forget, because I always forget, I want to thank everybody who has been listening to this, because for the longest time, this is just a little side project, and we were talking about this at lunch today.
Wait, people listen to this?
Well, that's nice. The thing. It was kind of a joke of like,
six downloads. Listeners, yeah.
But people have been messaging us.
Yeah, now there's actually an audience. It's great. So thank you, everyone who's listening.
So thank you. And to the people that have donated to the podcast, it's very kind of you. We have a new website, twomagiciansonemic.com. A lovely gentleman out of Orlando purchased the domain and was just forwarding it to our Podomatic page. And I said, hey, can I just buy that from you? He set it up, transferred it over. 20 books later, I own it, and just a nice gentleman.
That's cool.
So thanks, buddy. I appreciate that. And if you want to donate to the podcast, it costs like $20 a month to keep this going. There's a button right on the website. And I think it's tax writable, but although with the new tax laws, who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows?
I definitely don't.
But how are you, Simon?
I'm well. I'm exhausted, but good. It's a good feeling, like exhaustion from doing stuff.
I appreciate you doing this, because you literally just came in from, you were in Trinidad or somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere. Like, it was night? The Bahamas somewhere. Some island, I forget. It all blurs together. It's weird. Even the first time I did a cruise ship, it was this incredibly exciting experience. And the first time I went to the Bahamas, it was amazing. And it's still great, but it's happened so many times. It's like, oh yeah, I don't know, some island. I forget which one.
Yeah.
Anything can blur together after a while. So I flew in last night.
And that doesn't come, because I'm starting to do that too, that doesn't come from a sense of, oh, I don't take this seriously or whatever. You still like feel gratitude for being able to travel.
It's just that the exactly which island it was is no longer relevant data to you. That's not what matters now. It's like, yeah, it was a really great experience, and it's such a privilege and a joy to be able to earn money doing this. And it's still very, very hard work and very exhausting. And I've spent 12 hours on a plane, and then another 9 hours on a plane 4 days before that, and another, I don't even know how many hours on a plane before that. It's out of control, but it's still great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just part of the gig.
Exactly.
Part of the job.
I still do not even have silver status on any airline, because all my flights end up being with different random airlines.
That's so frustrating.
Flyer miles are doing nothing.
I see people posting, hey, I just got 2 million miles on United or America. I'm like, I would love that.
That'd be amazing.
One airline is American that they book you, one's United, and one's some airline you've never heard of.
That turns out it's on the SkyTeam Alliance, which is that weird third one.
I have 10,000 miles equally
spread
on all of the airlines.
Everything that is not enough for any kind of priority status.
And it's definitely first world problems, but
I just
want to get to a point of, you know, not being given the seat at the back of the airplane at first, and then being forced charged $80
honestly,
for an exit
row. It wouldn't even bother me if people ask, what are you doing? Oh, I'm doing working, flying everywhere. It's great, but exhausting. Yeah. And then everybody says, wow, you must have such great frequent flyer status. And I go, well, no. And if it weren't for everybody else making that comment, I wouldn't even think about it, because everyone makes that assumption, that faulty assumption.
Because that's the catch of doing cruise ships, is they book it for you, which is great, because it's not coming out of your pocket and you don't have to pay that back when you get paid 2 months later from the ship.
Yeah, and then you don't have to even deal with the logistical hassle.
Exactly.
You just turn up the airport when you're
told.
But
the catch is they're finding the cheapest flight available to save them money.
But also, even an I'm doing this right now because I'm actually about to go. I've got about a week and a half off, and I'm going to Australia to visit my parents and my sister, and I haven't seen them in ages. And I'm looking at flights and thinking now about, you know, is there anything I can actually get my status up to silver on? Everything's in bronze crap.
That's our priorities in life.
It's because look, when
getting
you're
up to silver,
well, but when
status.
You're flying this much, silver makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. It really actually does, because now it's relevant every couple of weeks rather than once or twice a year, like an average flyer. But the problem is there's the airline I might want to fly because it will get my points up. But then that's indirect, more expensive. And then the other one is a direct flight. I'm not going to book an indirect flight over a direct flight, mm-hmm. even if it gives me better status, because a direct flight is just so much better than the one with the stopover.
We got it.
And that's the problem. Yeah. Sometimes your airline of choice doesn't fly where you want it to fly, or at least doesn't do it well.
Got a companion pass for my wife with Southwest, which is the thing I like about Southwest is everybody except for like the first 15 people are pretty much equal. Yeah. You know, if you want a good seat, you just pay a little bit more. And it's kind of new now. And they give you the two check bags for free. Who does that?
Yeah. Southwest is, I've only had amazing experiences with Southwest.
It's never been bad. Even when it was delayed once where we were like circling Detroit because of a thunderstorm. And I'm like, they're going to send us to Chicago. We're going to run out of gas. Sure enough, we ran out of gas and they sent us to Chicago. And then they're like, we've kind of reached our flying hours. We need a new crew. So we sat in Chicago for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And that was my worst experience on Southwest. And I emailed them. I'm like, hey, I fly with you guys all the time, but this was really disappointing. Mm. And they sent me at least 2 or 3 vouchers for free flights.
Yeah.
So for the rest of the year, we flew for free on Southwest. So
that's pretty
good.
Cool.
Job, Southwest. Give me more money. Any other... You're working on 5 million. We just came from lunch at the castle, and all your friends are there. Everybody, hey, Simon, hey, Simon. And I'm like, this is what I get for scheduling this the second you get back. I'm just sitting there going, I got to go. I got to make a movie. I got to go see Black Panther.
I got to do these things. The castle, obviously being the magic castle. Again, I always like to assume that no one necessarily knows what the hell
not outside
one's
California
talking about. Yeah. Well, it's weird thinking about that's because, well, that's one of the things is I finally put up a new blog article at thingsbysimon.com.
This is a good one, yeah.
So we finally published the Macau story, the Show Me the Money, the true, genuine saga. I wouldn't normally call something an epic saga, but this one I think literally deserves that
title. I sent it to
title.
A writer friend, and he's like, yeah. Holy crap, that was a good story.
I'm glad.
It's making its rounds.
And but then since then, another story just happened that was another little weird piece of Magic Castle life. And the Macau story, I'm proud of it. I think it came out well. I spent months writing that on and off, just tweaking it and then redrafting it, then redrafting it. And I find writing exhausting and difficult. It's like that great Dorothy Parker quote. I hate writing, but I love having written.
Sure.
And there's nothing. Every time I find some great quote, it turns out to be by Dorothy Parker. She just nails it.
Who's Dorothy? I'm going to sound totally, dumb here, but who is Dorothy Parker?
I think she was one of those sort of polymaths. I know she was definitely a writer. I think she was an actress. Just one of those just multi-talented people from way back. Just one of those kind of sassy, intelligent broads from the 30s, 40s.
One 50s, of those actually, chicks.
Yeah, one of them. Like sort of Mae West and all that. There's these kick-ass ladies
awesome.
Who were full of sass and well-placed confidence. Rather
and Amelia Earhart type.
Yeah. Rather than, you see a lot of people with unwarranted confidence.
Oh,
they have more confidence than they should have.
I've been thinking about that a lot this week. That's my biggest turnoff in any capacity of false confidence and unwarranted confidence coming from a place of just being unearned.
Yeah, exactly. Versus people who actually are awesome and confident with that.
Yeah.
Like
and
Dorothy
most
Parker.
Of the time, those people are super chill, super relaxed. They've done these amazing things. Yeah, and we meet those people all the time here at the castle. Oh, you've done that?
Yeah.
You were part
Holy
of this?
Shit.
I bet somebody
amazing.
Who was the voice of our friend Sarah was the voice of Mary Jane on the animated Spider-Man in the 90s.
Wow.
And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah. And she's like, oh, yeah, that'll thing. No big deal. Whatever. Yeah,
moving on.
And yeah, so wrote a new piece called The Slushening, which is up there now, thingsbysimon.com. I can't remember. There was a reason for that. Blogs, saying stuff.
Writing. Coming from the story of the money, I think.
Who knows?
It's a good piece, though. That's up there.
That's right. And it's my second favorite thing I've ever written. I'm very proud of it. That's where I was going. I'm normally not proud of things I write. I think they're okay.
Yeah.
They're adequate. I read them back and go, yeah, this is all right. Whereas this one I read and go, oh, yeah, fuck, this is a great piece of writing. This one came out well. I'm really proud of this one.
That's good. I'm the opposite. I write something, this is great. And then a month later, I'll read it. I'm like, I put this up on the internet.
Yeah, I showed this to humans.
I should take many things down on my blog, but it's there, nickpaul.net/blog. shameless promotion.
Love that .net.
You want to know who nickpaul.com is?
Who?
He's some guy who true story, lived a couple blocks away from me when I lived in Chicago. Some artist dude who never updated the site.
Wow.
And it's partially my fault. I never reached out to buy it. But some artist guy, and that's why I have nickpaulmagic.com.
There you go.
So I have that .com.
Like, I guess I'm always wary of giving advice because everyone's life is in such a different position. But the advice, I guess, with the writing thing is, like, don't worry too much about being proud of your stuff. Or at least try to be. Strive for that. But you can, just because something's not the best thing in the world doesn't mean it's not necessarily worth sharing with the world. Put it up there anyway. And then every now and then you'll do something great. Not everything you do has to be great. It just has to be consistent. Get it out there. It'll gradually, eventually something great will happen.
And
maybe
it goes back to that Dorothy quote of writing, of I don't like writing, I like having written. Is that it? And that's how I feel about everything I do.
Well, that was, I wrote for Magic Magazine for just under 3 years. And I think in that, I'm not proud of this. This is not something to emulate. It's that saying, do as I say, not as I do. But I think maybe 2 out of those 30 months, I was actually on time for the deadline. Because every single time I was late, it was because I was so ashamed of the piece of shit that I had in its current form. I just didn't feel I could turn it in. It was better to be late and fix it up until it was adequate to get it in. And then I would get it in, I'd fix it at the last minute, just swearing and wanting to throw the keyboard across the room because I hated this piece of crap that I'd written. And nearly all of them ended up being at least okay. And lots of people liked them and everything. So I don't know if there's a moral to that.
I don't know. Just having consistency or just knowing when your work is ready to be released, I think that's a good quality to have.
One of the things, sometimes you want excellence. Sometimes all that matters is adequacy. Mm-hmm. So, and there's a time and a place for both. Sometimes it's better to get something out there that's just, okay, versus really waiting until it's great and polished. And
and we've talked this to death, so we don't need to talk it more. But just in terms of social media, that's like a legit thing of, I got to put this out. But it's like, well, that wasn't that good. Why do you need to share that? And I'm totally guilty of that, of just for attention's sake.
I just put a photo of me sitting in a shopping trolley.
It was a great photo. How everybody, like, including myself, is, hey, look at me, I'm doing this sweet gig. Oh, well, look at me, I'm on stage. You're like, I'm in a shopping cart in Spain.
They got like 6 times more likes than anything else I've ever put up.
And that's how it should be, because you're not promoting anything. Exactly. You're not talking about yourself.
I think this photo would be funny.
Mm-hmm. I need to learn from you.
What's that thing about, whether it's writing or photography or shows, rule number one, above else, try to serve the audience. Try to give something to the person viewing or consuming your thing. Whether it's, is it funny? Is it informative? Is it interesting? Is there something there of value to the person looking at it? And that can just be, you're a hot girl in a bikini and they want to perv on that. Yeah, that ticks that box, I guess. It's not a box I'm personally interested in ticking, but all right, you know, as long as is there that value to the person watching it or viewing it or
and I'm
whatever.
Learning having like really restrained myself from putting anything political up on social media, even if it's like a tiny jab, just being positive and being having a sense of fun always gains more attention, and I think is just works out better for people, and they it's just a better takeaway in the end, because I think people are just so bogged down with hearing, you know, the 24-hour news cycle of the world's on fire, we're all gonna die, when in fact I was reading an article in the New Yorker of like crime has gone way the hell down. Nobody knows why. Therefore, that's why rent's skyrocketing, because these places in New York in like the 70s and 60s are fine. Yeah.
Wow.
You can walk around.
That's
the
amazing.
Murder rate went from thousands to like 300.
Wow. Over how recently was this?
Like, it keeps steadily going down.
Wow. That's fascinating.
And I'm botching the data, but it's a fascinating read. And it's not the first time I've read that. Mm. And so, like, just the bullshit that politicians are spewing out of everything's terrible, you know, the terrorists are trying to kill us all the time. Actually, here's the data. Things most of the time are fine. Yeah, terrible things happen, but it's not as much as you think.
Well, it's also the difference is now we hear about every single terrible thing that happens everywhere.
Yeah, for clickbait or for they got to fill a 24-hour news cycle.
Interesting news. You know, tragedy makes good headlines and gets you clicks.
I'm reading verbal, just a bunch of interviews with writers and performers on The Daily Show from like when it started to when it ended after Stewart left. And the biggest turning point was the 24-hour news cycle. Mm. And, like, for them, 9/11 was this godsend. Like, we have something to talk about now and get to scare people.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's getting better, ultimately. But you wouldn't know it from, you know, watching television. So that's why, going back to what my original point was, that's why people, I think, crave this positive happy feeling of joy on social media,
in contrast to the media they're they're used to consuming via conventional channels.
Totally. And this kind of segues a little bit. I saw a concert from an artist. It was like a group called the Art of Ensemble, and they it's a string piano, a little bit jazz, a little rock guitar, all different styles of disciplines of music, and they take kind of contemporary songs and you know, have them composed in a different, slightly different way. And the lead singer, they work with different lead singers, and this one was Stephen Page, former frontman of Barenaked Ladies. I'm a huge Barenaked Ladies fan and a huge Stephen Page fan, so going to this concert was, you know, super exciting for me. But just for 2 hours, I was, like, in tears half the time because I'm having, like, this... My wife was with having, like, this transcendent experience, and it's, like, so childish and dumb, but... At the same time, like, oh, this is what I'm trying to do in my show.
Yeah.
I'm trying to take people on this, like, weird emotional journey, still making them happy, making them feel something, and just walking away with, holy crap, that was good.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that's what I got to keep working for, and I am a long way away from that. But it was – I haven't felt that in a long time because you see living in LA, you're so fortunate to see so many shows a week, you know, if you're going out doing stuff. And they're all fine, but it's kind of in and out, in one ear, out the other. And this was just like, still is sitting with me almost a week later. So
it was like an epiphany I had a couple of years ago, I think, when I was in the middle of a real sort of creative crisis. I'd been working on this show forever and it just wasn't really coming together. And it was just frustrating because it had this whole plot arc to it and I couldn't find a way to quite make it click and blah, 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 blah. And then went to I've never seen a lot of live music in my life. That just wasn't really a thing when I was growing up. And so it still never really had any bands I followed or went to their shows, which I feel sad about. I feel I sort of missed out on that piece of the human condition a bit, and went to see a concert right in the middle of preparing for another round of this gig and being all, I don't know how to do this. In fact, it was before Colorado, the one that you did the year after I did with Armstrong and everybody else.
Steamboat Magic.
Steamboat
Festival.
Magic. Freaking great, man. Great experience.
If you live in Colorado, it's in September. Go do it.
Yeah. One of my favorite gigs I've ever done. It was just so much fun. And part of that was because I went to see this concert with this friend who, at the time, we were dating. Now we're just friends, and it's great. And it was Rudimental, the band. And I just watched them, and they played, you know, a bunch of songs for about 2 hours, and the packed crowd, the crowd loved it. And I was so in this headspace of, you know, this show needs to kind of have an arc to it with an ending that's set up earlier that, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I watched the band just played a bunch of songs and everyone was so happy and loved it. And I went, you know, you don't need necessarily this overall flow or this arc or anything. You can just do a bunch of great stuff on a stage. And if it's just great and the crowd's there, and that can be a fantastic show that's as good as anything anyone's seen. And that was a real, in hindsight, it was kind of dumb, but an epiphany to me at the time. And I started I took a vacation from trying to do these shows that were these kind of concept shows and just started trying to do good stuff that pleased the audience and made them happy through, you know, being magical and comedic and emotional and all the different ways you can please a crowd. And it has been great in the last couple of years. And a lot of my ship shows and everything else has become stronger because of that, of just focusing on the craft and the execution and the technique, rather than the overall conceptual arc.
Yeah, that's something I've been struggling with a lot too, of just trying to create segues and create transitions and, you know, having a beginning, middle, and end of a show. Because sometimes, you know, you'll be thrown together. Okay, you got to do a 15-minute. Okay, you got to do a 20. Okay, you got to do your 45. And you don't have to look at it this way. But for me, it's like, okay, I do want a beginning, middle, and end. And I want there to be segues. And going to a concert is a great way to kind of learn from that. That's one thing I was reminded of last Sunday of, oh, you can do this crazy emotional piece and then just start talking to the audience, explaining something, and then go into another piece, another fun piece or a slow piece, and it's like, oh, you can do that, and it works.
Yeah, you don't need to have some clever segue that links it. You can just go, that was that, now for this.
Yeah.
And
because I think people are wired to just understand, okay, that was done.
Now this is what's happening. Mm-hmm. There's that sort of sense of, okay, we're doing this now. Cool.
Yeah.
And if they're liking you and they're enjoying the show, they'll accept almost anything from you.
Yeah.
Particularly something as simple as, right, now let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
You put yourself in the shoes of, you know, say you're watching a comedian or any kind of performer that you like and you're enjoying them, or a musician that you love. If they go, all right, now we're going to do this. Okay, cool. I'm down for that. I like this person. I like their work. Whatever they want to show me, I'm excited to see.
Yeah. And ultimately just comes down to personality. It's like if your character is strong enough on stage and if you're confident enough in who you are, I think the audience will follow you anyway.
Yeah, with earned versus unearned confidence.
Confident in... confidence on stage as opposed to off stage.
Yeah.
I'm very unconfident off stage.
Well, it's also that calm confidence, right? Which is that, that comes from a deeper place that you can usually sense.
And it's weird. I've been having these, I think I may have talked about it last month. I just have these like waves of like November, shitty shows, December, great shows, January, shitty shows. And now that we're in February, okay, we're doing fine again. But actually, I take that back. Yesterday was a good show. My show's Friday and Saturday, I was like, what the hell am I doing? I am awful at this. It's weird. There's just like this flow of confidence in this flow of just getting into the right vibe.
I get that with dating more than shows. That's really...
My shows,
my shows are usually pretty consistent, but dating is just the shit for months. And, oh, okay, no, it's good now.
See, I'm the opposite. I have a rock-solid wife. I love my wife to death. I have a great relationship. We've been together 10 years, but my shows are all over the place. So I guess I'll take it that way.
Maybe there's
no
some,
offense,
maybe,
but I'm going to take
fine.
It my way.
Maybe there's some cosmic balance there that something in your life has to be tumultuously great then terrible. Then, oh, no, it's actually really good. Oh, God, it's the worst.
Yeah. That's funny. And I don't say that to rub in anybody's face. It's marriage takes work, and it's a give and take. But I say on the surface compared to, like, how all over the place I am with my performing. Yeah. And she's seen me after shows and before shows. It's like, it's going to be okay. You've done this before.
See, that's true love. When someone's seen you before and after shows and still is still there for you.
Oh, yeah. There was, quick China reference.
If in doubt, it all comes back to China.
Not even, I wasn't physically throwing things, but emotionally wanted just to throw everything and just like, I'm done with this. I want to leave and walk off. On stage smiling 2 seconds later. It was good to work together for 3 months.
It's actually funny. I this has been a theme with many of our things. I like sincerity. I appreciate realness. I want to be, if I'm going to be respected, I want it to be for things I've actually earned. And likewise, I like it when people are themselves. You know, I like it when women fart in front of me because that's real. Like, that's an actual thing. Like, and it's a thing, like this whole trope of like girls being afraid to fart in front of a man. I don't know where that came from.
I'm still nervous to fart in front of my wife. But
there you go. You know, I want everyone farting in front of everybody because humans fart. That is a real thing that real people do. I want the realness.
You're literally Sidney Fife from I Love You, Man. Have you ever seen that movie?
No, I haven't.
You know, he's like, he just talks about it. He's like, I am a man. I have needs.
Exactly. So again, there's this sincerity. I appreciate knowing the real story. I like to know the real story, and I like it when people want to know my real story. I like sharing that. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's why we have found you more so, because you're much more social, better in small groups than I am.
Which is saying very little. But either of us, I am very much an introvert, but who still enjoys people.
In terms of, like, you're a much more extroverted introvert than I am.
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
Very
introverted. You're like full introvert. I'm just like semi-introvert.
But you have managed to find these groups in LA of all places of finding real people.
Yeah.
Like the people that we just had lunch with, friends of yours, people I know, acquaintances, but I'm like, oh, these are the most like down-to-earth LA people I've met because they're not talking about their next big project or
we're taking the piss out of those people, like, which happened at lunch when we were talking shit about someone who was doing that Cat's Pilates class or whatever
yeah.
it was.
Yeah, yeah, at a Pilates class.
Exactly. Which
I have to go to the BAFTAs.
Oh, yes, name drop these people I know. Fuck you. Don't be a wanker.
Yeah,
but
the
realness. This was segueing back to seeing you before a show. There are a few things more real than me before a show, and that's like people I've known, friends, or people I've been dating. Like getting to see me in show prep mode. That's a whole new level of realness.
Yeah,
and it's always funny because I know it's happened enough times now. I know it's going to be eye opening for them because people again. They only see the surface. They build up in their mind this image based on the surface that, oh, you know, you must be have your shit together and be pro and, you know, got this down. Oh, my God. No way. You kidding? Before a show, it's like, oh, fuck, where is this prop? Oh, God, apartment's in chaos. Oh, shit, this thing's half built. You know what? We don't have time. We'll do it anyway. Crap. All right, just chuck that in the bin. It's beyond anything you could imagine in terms of the chaos. That's
good. Yeah.
And that's natural. That's what it takes if you're a creative and you're inventing new things and you're trying new things. Yeah, it's this gyroscopic, almost overbalancing, barely controlled, just holds together in time for the show, and the show ends up being okay.
It's always
despite the
fine.
Chaos.
Yeah. Yeah, I've. It's taken me way too long to learn this, but I'm, you know, on ships especially because you have to do so much material that I'm like, yeah, I can do this. This is kind of new. I can do that. That's kind of. Yeah. And now I'm at the point of no. I do one new thing.
Yeah.
I focus all my energy on that, all my nervous energy on that, because something in it is going to screw up.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, even though I've rehearsed it 1,000 times, it's still going to screw up. And that way you can go back to your other pieces that you've done, you know, over and over, and they're in your physicality, and you don't have to worry about it.
Well, that's also that whole threshold of, it's a big question in magic is, when is a piece ready to do in front of a real audience? And there are a lot of different answers to that. And I know Eugene Berger, who sadly departed this earth recently.
Good guy, yeah.
Great guy. I mean, huge influence on me early on. Like, his books were some of the... Yeah, I'm so glad I read his books early in my magic journey because they really affected me in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean I agree with everything he said. I agree with most of what he said. But there was one thing I remember where he talked about that question in one of his books about when's a piece ready. And for him, it had to be so polished. It had to be... everything is worked out. Everything's ready before he would do it for a real audience. And I have a much more laissez-faire approach. I think as long as there's a pretty good chance it'll functionally basically work, I'll put it in front of a real crowd.
Yeah, that's what I'm at right now doing it.
Yeah, because for me, it depends on your metric of what is a successful show. And there's no right or wrong answer to this. For him, it was if everything was immaculate. Everything had to be really great in place. For me, the metric is, did the audience leave going, that was great, I really enjoyed that, yeah, like I'm happy of having seen that. And you can have a trick that goes chaotically, spectacularly wrong and still achieve that goal for the audience. Because as Teller of Penn & Teller beautifully once said about a trick he bombed with, was it failed as magic but succeeded as comedy.
Yeah.
And that statement right there is a mantra I go back to whenever something's crashing and burning live on stage. I'm like, that's okay. We can now treat this as comedy.
Yeah, be self-aware about it.
Yeah. Go, wow, that didn't... And it can be a really genuinely enjoyable, enriching experience for an audience to watch an accomplished performer crash and burn with something. Because that's a rare thing that you don't get to see. And watching an accomplished performer crash and burn, if you crash and burn with grace, that's actually a beautiful thing to watch. I've seen other performers do that. And when they crash and burn well, I want to applaud. I'm like... Good. That is the best
that's
way you could have salvaged that.
That's why I go to the castle on Mondays.
Yes.
Because it's everybody's first night. They're trying it. They're like, I'm going to try out all this new stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of what we were just talking about. And you just see them fail.
Yeah.
I saw three performers last week. They will remain nameless. One of them is a hero of mine and a friend. Actually, two of them are. Or just heroes of mine in terms of what they're doing and what I aspire to do. And that show didn't crash and burn. But
it was not.
And
great.
I had seen the show before.
Yeah.
Killed. Show they had already done before,
yeah.
And it was like, oh, that was really weak. But I was like, I'm really glad I'm in here to experience this because you have this idea of people that you respect never failing.
Yeah.
And then when you see them fail and how they handle failure, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. It's so, it's, I don't know, compelling, interesting. Again, it's that common theme of the surface versus the reality because, you know, we're not immune to that either. You project this idea of the person, and that's not the same as the reality. Again, whether it's on social media or what you see or what people think your organization system looks like. But yeah, and it's one of the marks of a real pro. It's not the only thing, but how well you handle like live failure. And it really shows that true inner confidence. If you know what you're doing, You can be in the middle of a crash and burn and be like, all right, that's okay. This is not the end of the world. This is bad, but show goes on. Life goes on. This is all right.
I have a hack example of that on last Friday. I had a great audience. They were probably, I was doing four shows at Disney, and they were probably the best audience of the night, and they were having fun, and I was doing balloon animal restoration.
Yeah.
And I pop it, I open it up, and the balloon is, I hit it too hard, and I destroyed the balloon.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, moving on.
Yeah,
yay!
Exactly.
And
yeah.
The audience was just having a good time. It was yeah. like, whatever. But yeah. if that were to happen to the audience prior, that was very judgmental of like, yeah. I don't know about this guy.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been as confident. Mm. And I would not have been able to stand my ground. But it was a good learning experience of keep on going. That's all you yeah. 'cause in magic, stuff is going to fail.
Yeah, at some point. That's again, I do a lot of teaching beginners magic. I really enjoy that. It's a I think, underserviced niche out there.
I'm pointing to one and blaming you right now.
I have pictures of promo photos of a magic student of mine on the wall who will remain nameless for this. And yeah, and it's one of the things that I know from experience. Like, learning how to teach is an incredibly complex task, and it's not easy. There's
oh,
that
I'm terrible at every time I do yeah. it. I have a teach a trick session for ships, and yeah. every time I'm like, "All right, now you blew your hand this,
do this thing,"
and then yeah. you guys got it, and they're like, "No."
Yeah, it's. I just think, as a side note, teaching, particularly primary and secondary teaching, is I think possibly the most important job in society, and tragically one of the most undervalued and underappreciated. And that dichotomy between how important it is for yeah. our entire society and how much respect and payment it gets is heinous.
Yeah. And the fact that it's funny how, like, only in recently I'm like, oh, I'm really bad at memorization, but that doesn't mean I was a bad student
yeah.
or a bad learner.
Yeah.
I just learned differently. And I always had decent grades, but, like, my sister, who's a genius, all 4.0s, got a scholarship
yeah.
to this amazing university in Paris. She, you know, has an amazing ability to remember yeah. things. And not that she's not an intelligent person and able to think critically, but her advantage clearly was she could read something once and remember yeah. it for a test, you yeah. know, which is a disadvantage to most yeah. children.
And I guess that's, yeah, to all the school teachers out there, but like the good ones. Because
yeah,
they're
fighting
them. There are plenty of crappy ones who just don't give
oh,
a shit.
Yeah, yeah.
But to the ones who actually care and actually try, you are the greatest heroes.
Oh, totally.
Because,
for like what
yeah.
you're getting paid.
Yeah, and for the amount of respect you get from society, you are goddamn
mainly
heroes.
Mainly from parents, you know, like
yeah.
parents
oh,
just
God,
treat
parents
teachers
are the
like
worst.
Shit.
Yeah.
Like, you're in the trenches with these
yeah.
kids all the
they
time.
They are doing arguably the most important job in society with some of the least respect and the least support and the worst education system that they are sadly burdened with having to teach to. It's, but yeah, I'm really passionate about teaching. It's it's a difficult skill. People don't even realize how much of a skill it is. That whole bullshit about those who can do, those who can't teach is
yeah.
sometimes true.
No, it is
absolutely
and I have,
not always.
And I have great teachers who I think that is true of,
mm.
but that doesn't, they were still inspirations
yeah,
to
exactly.
me.
Yeah, exactly.
And people who I think if they weren't teachers probably could have pursued their own careers,
yeah.
but you know, they didn't fall back on teaching, but they were like, oh, okay, I think this
yeah.
fits me better. And there's nothing wrong with
yeah.
that. And that's great. And that's amazing that
mm.
that's almost like an amazing selfless gesture to
yeah.
do of I'm going to let my dreams fade and, you know, educate people.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, I mean, and I obviously enjoy performing magic. You know, I'm reasonably good at it. I think that's a reason I can objectively say that. But I actually enjoy teaching it even more than performing it.
Oh, wow.
Because when I'm teaching, I can share all of it. Because when you're performing, you're sharing the tip of the iceberg. You're sharing the top part, not all the work that's gone into making that. And that frustrates me. Again, I want to share the realness. I want to share the true full story of everything. And when teaching, you can do that. You actually talk about the method and the training and the journey. And just things like learning how to be okay with the inevitability of screwing up a trick. Like on this last ship, I taught one of the cast members a card trick just because I like doing that. He was like, can you teach me a trick? Hell yeah, I can teach you a trick. I would love
to. I'm here
to.
For 7 days.
Hell yeah, exactly.
I got
time. Let's do it. And because I now know that I know how to teach this stuff. I'm constantly learning how to teach it better. There's no point where that plateaus.
Sure.
And the first time he did it, he screwed it up. He got one of the directions wrong. And as like most people do, it's like, oh no. I'm like, hey, do not, no. What you did was good. You just got that. You just got your first screw up out of the way because it was going to happen eventually.
Yeah.
Might as well get it out of the way early. Now, what do we learn from that screw up? Now, let's try it again straight away. And he was like, oh, no, I want to take a week before I try it. No, we're trying it again right now. And if you screw it up four times in a row, that is fine. Like, again, like how to teach, making people okay with the inevitability of messing up and how to learn from that and how to, again, treat that as a comedic moment, being ready for when the, not if, but when the screw ups happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's that line that a pro, you know, you just look at magic, but it's true of many industries. A pro magician has screwed up more performances than the amateur has even done performances and learned from all of them and continued on despite that.
Well, I mean, that's the biggest thing that I learned later in life about failure is, like, society kind of teaches you that if you fail, you're a screw up and you're never going to be
fucked and unhealthy.
But, like, the only way I've ever learned is from failing on stage. Yeah. Of, oh, that definitely doesn't work and that needs to change. Yeah. And there's still bits in the show of, it's okay, that needs to be changed, but it hasn't screwed up yet, so I'm just going to leave it.
Yeah.
And it's just pure laziness.
Failure provides you with useful data.
Yeah, because you never want to experience that again. Yeah. It's just, it's going back to, all right, well, we're going to go through this as a group, and it's how you handle it and how you get through it.
Well, also, until you've failed at something, you don't really know on a gut level how to plan to avoid that failure happening again. You can imagine it, and now over years of doing this, I'm better at sort of working on a new routine and going and being able to imagine all the likely failure cases of ways this could go wrong and planning ahead for them.
Yeah, sure.
But even that attitude is only through having had the actual failures. So learning how failures happen, what kinds of failures take place, the kinds of situations, and starting to recognize those in advance that are likely to make something go badly wrong.
Mm-hmm. And this is actually like literally what I have written down of learning from my mistakes.
There you go.
And I'm just going over, you know, anytime I have a show that was had simultaneously good points and bad points, I'll journal about it.
Mm.
And in this case, it was the last time I was on a Disney ship in August. And I'm like, all right, this work, and I'm going back on a Disney ship this week for the first time since then. And I always see that as like kind of a different battle than other ships because they're kind of, it's a smaller line, they pay more attention to who they're booking, and it's kind of more of a niche thing as opposed to other cruise lines where there's like 16 ships and you can do your thing and it'll be fine. So I'm really trying to like go through, okay, what screwed up, what needs to be improved, and checking all those boxes before I get back on there on Thursday. And I'm sure I'll screw up new things and find new things that need to be changed, but I'm just trying to get in my brain and in my, you know, in my stuff and in my body even of, okay, this has been adjusted, this has been improved, make this better, make this, you know, alter it. And I think ultimately it'll make a difference.
Hugely. I mean, I on a ship gig recently, I had a weird show. It wasn't bad. People liked it. But I had at least three in the 45-minute show minor to medium screw-ups just due to brain farts, just having done the stuff too many times and not been as present as I should have been. And there's no way to plan for that. You can't plan for a brain. And I was jet lagged. I was tired. I was, you know, trying to be fully present. I was taking it very seriously, but just had a few little moments where it was just, something
just
fumbled.
Your brain just isn't snapping as fast.
Every now and then. And you got to be ready for that. That's an inevitability. Things aren't perfect.
And that's another reason not to try out too many new things in a show, because
given that even your stable things aren't always guaranteed to work, because nothing's ever guaranteed to work in life in any way ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless it's a one-way force deck.
Even then, you could shuffle it and they pick the bottom X card.
Yeah.
Right? Can happen.
Oh, man, you were just saying that and I had a thought and then it lost me. Go back, train of thought. Cripes.
Learning from mistakes, cruise ships, Disney, something. It'll come back.
No, it's gone.
Eventually.
Dead. Over. But yeah, just the ability to react correctly in those moments and go, all right, now how do I pick up the pieces?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the only way a show can truly fail is if the audience is, like, alienated, angry, uncomfortable, sad, feels, what was this shit? And, again, if they... It was that thing that Max Maven talked about, is they don't necessarily have to like you, but they still have to find you interesting and compelling. And, obviously, it's better... Liking you is going to give you more leeway if something goes wrong. They go, oh, I like that guy. Yeah, the show was a little skew-whiff, but I could... you know, they could tell it was something that unexpectedly gone wrong.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I had the thought of... You were talking about doing being jet lagged to doing the amount of shows, and I'm realizing I do much better shows. I have way more fun on stage when there's like a gap from the amount of times I've performed.
Oh yeah. Because then you're actually excited to perform again.
Yeah. Did a show last night for the first time since Saturday, and it was like, okay, I had that time to relax and kind of think about it, as opposed to, you know, doing, if you do, when I do Disneyland, I'm doing 4 30-minute shows in a day. And by that last one, even when the audience is great and having fun, I still am exhausted. And the only thing I want to do is go home.
Yeah.
And that's just being honest.
What's that? I always think of it as the chocolate cake theory. Chocolate cake's delicious, but not four
it's
times a day.
Cake. Yeah.
And you've eaten chocolate cake 4 times a day for the last 6 days. And, oh, a slice of chocolate cake.
That's how.
Whereas if it's been a week, it's like, oh, yeah, would love a slice of chocolate cake.
That's how Andy Richter described when Conan was canceled, when he lost The Tonight Show. They went on tour. And they were just there's a documentary about it called Conan Can't Stop. It's very good. I'm a big Conan nerd, so I ate it right up. But there's a part where they're just sitting backstage at one time. He's like, Conan goes, this is amazing, but I don't know how we could do this all the time. How do people do this all the time? And Andy Richter goes, it's chocolate cake.
Oh, really? Is that the same thing?
He said the same
exact
thing.
That's hilarious.
You know, it's good in small bursts, but all at once, it's too much.
Yeah. It's always interesting, that idea of ideas that genuinely different people have simultaneously, which makes sense. Again, Max Maven, smart guy, had a theory about that, which is this whole idea of people, the issue of intellectual property theft and plagiarism in magic or in any field. Like, say someone invents a trick and then someone else has a very similar trick. Well, did they get the idea from that person and steal it, or did they independently come up with it themselves? And sometimes there's no way to know, you know, short of one person lying. Sometimes without lying, you might not even know that you were inspired by that subconsciously, seeing it years ago and having forgotten about it. That does genuinely happen. It's a minority. But
comedians all the time.
Yeah. But the, and Max sort of had this theory that some ideas aren't really worth protecting because they're obvious enough that it seems likely. And he talked about the whole monkeys, infinite monkeys on infinite typewriters will eventually type out the works of Shakespeare. And he went, you know, it's an old idea. And if it was infinite and infinite, then yeah, it probably would happen. But what if it's only like 100 million monkeys and 100 million typewriters? It probably wouldn't get Shakespeare. But like, what's the odds of just getting, say, Hamlet? This is all paraphrasing Max. See, crediting, it's important, right? Credit your sources when you can remember them. What if you just got Hamlet? Okay, but that's still unlikely. What if just the to be or not to be soliloquy? That's now much more, maybe 10,000 monkeys on 10,000 typewriters might get there. Obviously, that's the wrong numbers probabilistically, but, you know, smaller number. What about just the phrase to be or not to be? That is the question. That's now getting into the realms of possibility. What about just the phrase to be, T-O space B-E? That could well happen even for 100 monkeys and 100 typewriters in a day. You might actually get to be. And his theory was that, Max's point eventually, was that, say, a coin in sugar packet trick is the magical equivalent of the phrase to be. It's not a particularly big creative leap. It ain't Hamlet. It ain't the works of Shakespeare. A monkey and a typewriter could have eventually randomly come up with that. If you go, well, what objects exist? Coins, sugar packets. Maybe one of them can go in one of them. And so I'm thinking about that with the chocolate cake theory. That's about the same thing in terms of thinking about it. Yeah, of course, that's not a big revelation. It's not surprising two people would have come up with the same analogy.
Yeah. And
let's see. What's a delicious thing that's less delicious if we have too much of it?
And I think a lot of that hostility comes from people just not wanting to admit that they weren't as original as they thought.
Yeah. Well, it's the problem, because with like plagiarism or like overlap of stuff, you have in psychology, which was one of my majors along with software engineering at university, you have this idea of a type 1 and a type 2 error in statistics in a research study. And I may have these mixed up, but one of them, type 1 or type, one of them is where your stats tell you there is an effect. Like, does handing people a cold cup of coffee make them rate people lower on personality tests? That was a real study. Like, coldness, does that make you evaluate thing? One of the errors is it is having an effect, but your stats don't show it. Like, your stats miss that there was actually something causal going on. And the opposite one is when there's no effect, but your stats do show an effect, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously the two ways stats can be wrong is, and again, it's only probabilistic. You can never be certain in statistics, but you can guess it. And yeah, the two errors, one is where you get more than you should, one is where you see less than you should. Same thing happens in, did someone steal this person's trick or bit? You know, the normal, most common one is, yes, this person stole this person's trick and they got away with it and that's bad. But then the other one that gets less attention is, no, they didn't steal it. They completely came up with it independently, but people accuse them of stealing it.
Yeah.
And that's the type two error. And it's a difficult because sometimes it can be kind of gray which one's going on, and you get people, again, won't name names, but who are very prone to type two errors. Like they see something even faintly similar to their thing, and they go, this first person goddamn stole my thing. It's like, fuck you. It's not similar enough, and it was a separate thing.
That happened to me with the card to mouth and the balloon that I do. Cards go in the balloon, find a card with my mouth. Like, I'll be the first to, not the most original premise, but
it's not a great leap in terms of monkeys and typewriters.
I had the idea to put the two together independently.
Yeah.
And I had some guy send me an angry email, say, hey, you ripped that off from me. And I sent back a strongly worded email like, well, you're not doing it with mime. You're not doing it this. You're doing the routine's completely
also
different.
No, I didn't, because it was my idea. I had the idea.
And I'm
separately.
Like, I came up with this in my, you know, bedroom by myself. And then I saw another group of guys, I think in Europe, doing a similar version.
And
I didn't accuse them of ripping it off. I'm
because
no,
it's a reasonably obvious linkage. Yeah. But again, it's tricky. There is that, and different people have different thresholds on where they think the threshold should be. There is no one accepted answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
Like this idea that I've seen magicians espouse that I disagree with is saying, even if you independently invent a thing, the person who first independently invents it should be able to have domain over that. And I disagree with that. I don't think, but there are many magicians who believe that. And who's to say who's right or wrong?
I think
that's
it just
a philosophical
comes down to what you were just
view.
Describing of how big of a leap in originality is it? Like with Teller's shadow routine of cutting the shadows off of a rose petal.
Yeah.
That's something he fought for and won because it's like no one else is doing that.
Fiercely original. Like
and
an absolute amazing leap of
started doing that
artistic
on
concept.
On TV and said, no, I definitely didn't rip that off. You didn't rip that off?
Yeah, and again, there's no way to know. I mean, maybe one in a billion, the guy really did have the... But again, you have to go with Occam's razor at that point. I mean, that's the way the legal system works. You know, you can never know for certain. You can just look at the evidence, go with, you know... There's that whole difference in law between balance of probability versus beyond reasonable doubt. And I think the Rose thing was, beyond reasonable doubt, this guy was lying and ripped off Teller.
Yeah.
And you can never know definitively 100%, but you eventually make that judgment call.
And I think going back to, like, if in my case, if some, like, there's a couple little bits that I've incorporated in this balloon routine that I've discovered over the years of doing it that I'm like, okay, I have a false ending. I have this bit in the middle. I have that. If I see somebody doing that, you bet your ass I'm going to say, hey, that's mine.
Yeah.
There's no way you didn't not
that
also come up
exact
with that.
Thing.
But if you're finding a card, you know, in a balloon
with
your
mouth,
face,
then all right, that's
the card to mouth trick has been around for over 100 years, so it's like there's no way I could claim that you know without you know being an egomaniacal man about it.
Well, it's and it's tricky sort of because there's things, you know, for example, I do one of the things I'm known for is a really good bill change. And so, and I got the idea for my bill change from another person's bill change that was published and legit, and I bought it and then modified it a lot over decades and eventually came up with mine. And so I sometimes, when I see people do versions of that guy's one that looks similar to mine, they're not usually not as good, but it's like, you know, I get prickly. I sort of, you damn it, you thief, hackles rise up. But I have to remind myself, no, there's I don't own the concept of a visual bill change. That would be, again, a type two error for me to pass judgment on that person.
Sure.
And again, I mean, type one errors are a much bigger problem where, people steal shit all the time. And it's a massive endemic problem in many of our industries.
There's a, I won't name him because I want him on the podcast and I want him to tell the full story. But there's a magician, did a show. Some person comes up and says, hey, that was great. I loved it. I'm a clown and I was inspired by that. And I'm going to write a routine based off of that. And he goes, no, you're not.
Yeah.
Please, this guy is super nice. Yeah. One of the nicest, I think, magicians working. Yeah. Super cool guy, I'll tell you after. And he's like, wait, what do you mean? He's like, no, you're not going to do that. If you do that, I'm going to sue you.
Yeah.
And it kind of caught me by surprise that this particular person, who's like a super nice guy, would say that. But it was absolutely warranted.
Yeah.
And the people have this idea in magic that it's okay just to rip off a whole routine.
Well, lame, shitty people have that idea.
We do, And that's, you know, I used to get mad at that, and I don't anymore. I mean, because we're not in the same category of gigs.
But I mean, it's worth, you know, if not, I mean, you could, you know, the Dalai Lama would tell you nothing is worth getting mad about ever. But I think it's worth fighting about because it's an important issue. And even if it's not hurting you directly, it's still allowing this idea to flourish that that's okay to do. And it's lots of people get hurt by that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It was weird. I remember I once someone did that, basically copied one of my routines and said, and didn't realize that wasn't okay. But what was great, he sent me an email. He'd sort of, he was aware it wasn't great, but he was kind of wanting to check if maybe he could anyway. And it was a really hard email to answer because he's a good guy. He was wanting to do the right thing. And the way I explained it is like, if I eventually, I travel a lot, if I end up in your city or in different cities doing a gig, which I might want to one day, like I want to tour my show, and I do my routine and someone's seen you, they're going to look at me and go, oh, this Coronel guy copied this other guy's routine.
Yeah.
That's where the damage is. Mm-hmm. And that can happen potentially anywhere. And if that happens once, that's still too much because then that's why it's hurting you.
Yeah.
Because now you look like the uncreative one. Because people assume the first person they see do a thing, that person invented that thing, which is dumb, but that's what people think.
Yeah, there's a mentality that that's okay to do. I've had somebody sent me a message, too, of a routine, not a trick I came up with, but the routine I came up with. And he's like, hey, can I do this just for school shows?
Yeah,
if it's just for school shows. Because
then some of the parents will see it, or those kids will, five, 10 years from now, one of them might be having a function. Like, no, it eventually has...
And the truth of it is, I agree with you, but I don't even see it that way. I see it as just purely of just forcing people, just putting a foot down. That's not okay to do. Yeah. It's not okay to take other people's routines verbatim. The trick and the routine are two separate worlds. It's apples and oranges in my mind. And if you're taking the routine, then it's. Why are you in this? Yeah. Why are you stealing people's stuff?
And it's also the other thing that happens is if, say, he's doing it at school shows, eventually that increases the odds of another unethical magician seeing that and stealing it from that guy.
And then suddenly they tell two friends?
Exactly. And it goes exponential. And that's why there are still things that, fortunately, most people are ethical and great, but there are routines I now won't do at the castle because there's too many magicians around and some small percentage of them. It's a minority, but it's we'll quote unquote get inspired by it, and then they'll be doing it without mentioning it. Then someone else will see them, and then they'll think it's okay to take. And suddenly, so it happened to I forget which routine it was. It happened to Penn Jillette with it was some juggling thing because he used to be primarily a juggler, and there was something that
I think you know what you're talking
is
about.
Now I can't remember what it was, but I know it's now a kind of I'm not in the juggling world, but it's now a quote unquote standard bit that apparently he invented. And just gradually the ripoff cascade happened.
Well,
people don't even know it was his bit.
Yeah,
because
he's gone up to people street performing and go, that's a great bit. Where did you come up with it? And they go, oh, no, that's just a street thing.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, actually, I came up with that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how that can happen. Mm-hmm. And it's, it can not take that many years before one of your bits can spread like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the other reasons it's important to lock that down. Even if it's someone who is just doing it somewhere, then someone else will see that and then...
Yeah, because I'm in a harder category of it because I don't invent the magic per se. You're very good at inventing the magic, and I'm getting better at that, building the methods and whatnot. But the routines have always been important to me, and I don't think enough people spend enough time on the routines.
Yeah, and the routine's more important than the method by miles. I mean, the method matters, but the routine is what the show is.
And if that's what's being ripped off, that's just horrible. Yeah. Because that's just effort and time. And it's one thing to learn the trick and do the trick and go, okay, that's the trick. But to do it with all the beats and all the moments.
All of that.
It's like taking, it's one thing to take the script, but then to produce the whole movie, things that people have worked really hard on and spent lots of time at. It's tough.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. We're at 50-ish.
My God.
55. We were supposed to be done 15 minutes ago. Because you're a busy man.
Got a gig tonight.
Performing for the NBA.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
I don't know. Probably. It's probably fine. I know Eric Jones did. He was on Instagram doing performing at the NBA with the weekend in LA. I'm like, all right, cool. I'll see you there.
I'm not legally allowed. Contractually, I'm not allowed to say I work at Disneyland, but people post about it all the time.
Yeah.
Like, and they've tweeted that I'm going to Disney has tweeted that I'm going to be there. I'm like, I don't think anybody really knows at this point.
Yeah. I just mean, I just have
forgiveness.
Again, it's as we never, ever, ever shut up about. I just have no interest in telling anyone what I'm doing. I just don't care about.
And that's why you're the busiest man in show business.
I
mean,
I honestly, though, I'd be busier if I did. Like, I know I should be spending more time humble bragging online or whatever the hell you're meant to do, because then people, you know, success breeds success and blah, blah, blah. And then you look like you're all blah, 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 all that crap.
But well, there's an element of doing it where, like, you're kind of secretly bragging of, like, I've been trying more and more to make crack jokes about, yeah. Like, I was on, I don't know if I mentioned this or not, I was on Holland America in November, and the program, the photo was wrong. It was some guy who was, like, 30 years older than me, and now presenting the magical comedy of Nick Paul. It's like, yeah, this old juggler dude who, I think, a friend of yours.
That was hilarious.
And I think he may have even seen it through the Facebook, right? And nice guy, so it was hilarious, it was, but it's like, okay, I'm simultaneously promoting that I'm doing a ship, but also making fun of... It's not as glamorous as it seems, because they can't even get my photo right.
it's not even like the whole bragging thing, just even informing people who are interested in knowing. I just don't, even that annoys me. I just don't even care about it. I know, again, I force myself to do it because I know it is, you know, like Eric, right? He's doing the right thing. It's a sensible business practice to let people know that you are busy and doing stuff and remind them that you exist, because that's often how people get booked. It's just, who were they last thinking about when they go, oh shit, I need a magician, whatever. It's often just that recency effect. So it is smart. And I should be doing more of that. I just despise doing it.
That's okay.
But hey.
That's why you have standards.
Judgmental personality calls here on Two Magicians.
That wasn't that judgmental. I meant that as a good thing. I have no standards.
Ah, right.
Anyway, thanks for listening. If you liked us, please donate a buck or two right on the website, twomagiciansonemic.com. If you liked us, you can follow us on the social media. At Nick Paul Magic, at Things by Simon. I should create an Instagram for Two Magicians, because we have a Twitter. It's at Two Magicians.
Oh, yeah.
I just don't want to do it.
Does it get things? It's so, and also, to our more increasing number of listeners, let us know what you are enjoying hearing about, what you would like to hear more about.
Yeah, there's a form right on the website. You can send fan mail or hate mail right there, or the email is twomagiciansonemic@gmail.com.
Also, because I think Instagram is bullshit and Twitter at least encourages conversation.
To everybody, please stop sending me messages on Instagram.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't want to respond. It's that it doesn't give you notifications.
Yeah.
And then I see it a week later.
Yeah,
and you're like, who, what? Sorry.
Yeah. Also, Instagram's the worst. It encourages vacuous narcissism. I will respond to any question posted to me on Twitter. I have a blanket.
Twitter's pretty good. Same with Facebook messages. I don't mind, like, if we're not friends, I'll still try to like take a peek and see.
Whereas the UI on Facebook is so horrible that it's just hard to find the messages and all that crap. And
you know what I downloaded? I downloaded the desktop version. There's some free software on your Mac.
Mm.
Or probably for PC too, of just, it's only Facebook Messenger. So it's like WhatsApp.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All you see is the Facebook Messenger. Mm. And it's changed my life.
Oh, really?
Because I don't have to go on Facebook. I don't have to get distracted by unnecessary things. So it's useful. But now I use iMessage, WhatsApp, Facebook Message, email, probably Twitter.
Yeah.
Five ways to communicate with people when really we could just be calling each other.
The only one I promise to respond to is Twitter. Tweet me and I will reply.
Not even email? Yeah, you're the worst.
I am the worst at email. God.
Your phone is open right now. How many are right there?
253.
253 notifications right there, on the app.
Yeah, and that's ones that need some kind of action. Like the other ones, I've already deleted all the spam. Like that's ones I need to either look at something or reply to something or something. Many of them are months old. I'm really bad with email.
You know, I'm not proud of that. I've just discovered.
Not a good thing.
I have a personal email that I really only use for spam or like nothing, promotions.
Yeah.
And I have a Gmail app for that. And then I have all my work email going in a separate app. And that's been very helpful because you don't get as distracted.
Yeah. I mean, I have different email addresses. Like, one's the business one. One's the one I use to sign up for websites and get all the mailing list crap.
Yeah, and just take that out of the mail app.
Yeah.
And that way you can, like, once a week, you go delete all those if you even really want to.
Well, the problem is, though, I'm pretty on top of those because those are easy. I just delete, keep the one thing that actually has the coupon code I want or whatever. It's the actual ones that I need to reply to that are the problem because I get into stress mode. That's a whole different podcast. So Simon's email ish and mental health issues.
We'll get back to that. Stay tuned for Simon's email woes.
Email and mental health woes.
Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Find us on Twitter.
Find us on Twitter. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Two Magicians One Mic Podcasts. Please rate us on iTunes. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Visit our website, www.twomagiciansonemic.com. Send fan mail or hate mail to twomagiciansonemic@gmail.com. Have a great week.